Right, it's a very great pleasure to me to welcome Professor Robert Trivers from Rutgers here to the place where I began my own studies in Darwinism in about 1960. Robert Trivers was one of the pioneers in the same field, and I met him about 9 years later at Harvard when he was still undergraduate. And he was just talking about his ideas about reciprocation and the role which long-continued relationships might have to play in making that a more likely evolutionary development. I immediately recognized a very important new idea, and I have vague memories that I, seeing that Bob hadn't published it after about 2 years, I began to think of pinching it myself. Fortunately, I wrote to him and asked him whether he was intending to publish it, and he said he was, so I gave him time. And thereafter, I've used it a lot, and I may say that that seminal paper of 1971 has, through the further development, quantitative development by Robert Axelrod at Michigan, become an enormous mushrooming field today of a whole theory of reciprocation. And I would also say that all Bob's contributions in those early days, every one of them has become a classic. I think that can be said of all his five earliest papers, just to remind myself what they were. In 71, the evolution of reciprocal altruism. 1972, parental investment and sexual selection, the importance of the difference of the size of the broods which the male and the female can achieve in most species, and the different variances that this implies. 1973, Trivers and Willard, almost a pair of names on everyone's tongue, except that nobody seems to know exactly who Willard was. parental offspring conflict in 1974, well, I need say no more about that, fairly obvious. In 1976, he published Haplodiploidy and the Evolution of the Social Insects in Science, a paper on a topic very close to my heart, because I had worked on it quite a bit, but pointing out several things which I had not spotted, which opened up another whole new field in the study of sex ratios in social insects, which still continues again to this day. Then 1976, sexual selection, and of course, this comes to his Jamaican lizards and so on, more down-to-earth practical biology, and I don't know so much about that, and I'll have to turn the page, so I think I'll leave it there. Anyway, just to continue with his history, I think I'd better summarize it pretty quickly now. One could say he spent a fair bit of time on the East Coast at Harvard, then he spent a fair bit of time on the West Coast at Santa Cruz, and just recently, he's come back to the East Coast, to Rutgers, where one hopes he's going to spend a fair bit of time. What more need I say? This topic of self-deception was one which I was skeptical about when I first heard it, but have since become convinced that it is indeed a very substantial topic for evolutionary theory and for psychology. I don't know quite where he's brought it to at the moment. I'm dying to hear, and so I think I'll just at this point simply hand over to Bob to tell us what he believes, he thinks about self-deception.
Well, thank you for the introduction. It's a great pleasure so far to be here, and also a considerable honor. In progressive evolutionary circles in the U.S., the Darwin Seminar is regarded as the premier lecture in evolutionary biology, or at least some of its more interesting subsections. And I think it's a great achievement of Dr. Cronin, a philosopher in an institution that lacks a biology department, to, in a few short years, have pulled off this trick. I hope you'll permit me to dedicate this talk to the memory of two individuals who cannot be here today except perhaps in spirit, and they are Robert Silberglied and Huey P. Newton, and I'll return to them in a second, but I thought I would first just outline the content of the talk. I'm not sure I'll end up having time to include everything, but I will start with the dedication. I will try to outline the major logic for self-deception that I've tried to pursue in my thinking. I will then present some, or review some, experimental, and I call it physiological work, because some of it is physiological, but I didn't want to quite call it biological, because the physiological work was done by psychologists. There's very little work along these lines, and much, much more is needed in order to get some real scientific information about the processes going on in the brain. I will then try to describe possible interactions of the logic I present here with other biological systems, parent-offspring conflict, genomic imprinting, and so on. I will briefly, and alas, very briefly, consider an interesting literature that has grown up in psychology regarding self-deception as a or some forms of it as a positive illusion with benefits to you directly, never mind the benefits that I ascribe, which is the better deception of others. Then I want to return to the cost of self-deception, which I'll touch on briefly in the dedication because I think it's so important, and especially emphasize the cost at the group level and a possible analogy between self-deception in organizations and self-deception within the individual. And then I will summarize. Bob Silberglied was a colleague of mine when I taught at Harvard. He was teaching entomology while I was teaching social behavior. He was a good friend, very helpful when I did the social insect work. He was a good person. He tragically perished in the crash of Air Florida Flight 90, I believe, something like in January of 1982. This was the flight that took off from Washington's airport and landed in the Potomac River. He was flying, the flight was on the way to Tampa, and he was continuing on down to Panama where he worked at the Smithsonian. If I could have the first slide.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Good.
And then focuses just those two. Gotcha. Yeah. If I mess up.
Ask me when you
want to use something. Yes. Okay. Okay, fine. Thank you. I don't suppose there's a pointer of any kind, but I'm so close, I guess I can just point like so. Well, this is an example of Bob's work. This is a beautiful example of mimicry that he discovered down in Panama. Looks very much like a snake's head with the eyes, the scales. In color, the actual pattern of coloration resembles strikingly a highly poisonous snake in Panama. The snake's head is, the shape of the snake's head is beautifully given. It is in fact the pupae of a butterfly. And his discovery of it has some mild interest because he described himself as rushing back to lunch at Barrow, Colorado Island, a little bit inattentive. He passes a bush. He freezes when he spots this dangerous snake. He then slowly moves sideways while watching the snake to see if it strikes, but noticed it did not orient toward him. Then he was able to notice that it was only the snake's head, so he thought it was a snake that had been consumed by a bird with a head impaled. And then, as a good entomologist, he saw the connection, and he realized it was a pupae. But so good was the mimicry that he described his hand as shaking when he went to collect the specimen. Now, I was listening with unusual interest to television about this crash, in large part because Bob was on it, and they played a short 2 or 3 weeks after the crash on national TV, an audio tape of the discussion between pilot and co-pilot during takeoff. And their roles were reversed, which we think contributed to the disaster. We being me and Huey Newton, who wrote a paper on it. The co-pilot was flying the plane. The pilot was supposed to be acting as co-pilot. You could hear in the voice of the co-pilot his fear as he went down the runway and tried to interpret contradictory or misleading information from the instrument panels, which later were shown to be giving misleading information. That's, of course, the job of the co-pilot to do that. He keeps raising the issue with the pilot. Then you hear a much more confident voice from the pilot who gives a rationalization for this speed, which indicated they were in danger. That's the only comment he makes. Now they lift off, and the co-pilot shuts up, and the pilot starts talking, and it sounds like he's talking to the airplane. Just climb, just barely climb, so on. It's too late. The disaster's already there. The last comment is the co-pilot says, "We're going to crash, Larry," and he says, "I know," and then there's a sound of impact. So I was working at the time with Huey Newton, who was a graduate student at the University of California, Santa Cruz, on a book on deceit and self-deception, which, needless to say, has never appeared. And we thought it might be a paradigmatic example of the cost of self-deception. Needless to say, you study the cost of self-deception always in retrospect. You don't arrange experiments. So it's not in the form of scientific data, but a retrogressive analysis. So we sent for the tape, which is provided by the National Safety Board, and I think it's very fine that they do, of the full conversation during the 40 minutes while they're waiting to take off. And we thought we could read back into that conversation the same kind of split, where the co-pilot was rational and nervous and had good reason to be nervous. The pilot was overconfident. And you had these kinds of mental operations. For example, a co-pilot would say to the pilot, "How much snow do you have on the wings?" That turned out to be a critical variable causing the crash. And the pilot would give a dismissive, diminutive answer, just a little bit on mine, and the co-pilot would say, "A quarter to a half an inch on mine." It was the same on both wings. There was another sort of gruesomely tragic exchange where the co-pilot calls attention to the fact that they were de-iced quite a long time ago. In fact, that was the plane that went the longest between de-icing and taking off. And he said, "It gives you a false sense of security." And the pilot says, "Yes, that satisfies the feds," and then deflects the conversation off into a discussion of how it should be set up, not without its use, but inappropriate to the situation at hand. Let's see, forward. Oh, let me, before I turn to dedicating it to Huey Newton, let me just say that the study of deception in nature of this sort between members of different species is a big, rich literature, and it's well worth studying. There's no moral problem involved. I don't know a moral system that requires you to give accurate information to your predators, and you can study the beauty, the humor, and the skill of deceptive maneuvers, and I just want to give you two examples. This at first glance, and let me see if I can focus it a little bit better. Yeah. This at first glance looks like a spider. The spider's eyes here, its abdomen. This is a very particular species of spider that's colored that way on its abdomen, its eyes here. It has a kind of orange thorax and what look like the legs of a spider. But this is, in fact, a fly, and it is oriented that way. This is the abdomen of the fly with these false eyes. That's its thorax. These are black markings on its wings. Now, the beauty of this example is that the predator on the fly is precisely this spider. So it is imitating its predator. Well, how does this work? It spots a spider creeping up on it. It turns back ways. And then it raises and lowers its wings, which mimics the territorial display of the spiders where they raise their legs. The predator then responds to it with a similar territorial display and backs off. Now the next slide is my favorite example of mimicry for whatever it reveals about my psyche. And this is a very common form of mimicry in nature. This is a moth resting on a green leaf and is mimicking a bird dropping. So it's mimicking that which it does not wish to become in order to avoid becoming it. And of course, there's a little psychological twist here in that you can well imagine that a bird that had a hypothesis might not want to subject it to a test, might not want to get bird feces on its beak, for example. Okay. Now, this is a famous poster of Huey P. Newton. He was the founder of the Black Panther Party, a radical black organization in the late 60s that tried to control the misbehavior of the police. He has a spear in one hand and a rifle in another hand and a somewhat serious expression there, and he's sitting in a kind of colonial chair. Now, this was a popular poster in the Times, and the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, where it started, had this poster in their window. And one night, the police came by and shot up the poster as they wished they could shoot up Huey P. himself. They didn't quite do fatal damage to him even then. So Huey promptly made another poster, which was even more popular. And that was the shot-up poster of the first version. He was a great pleasure to meet after leaving Harvard at 78 because he was a genuine political radical, and it never occurred to him for a moment that evolutionary theory would force him into some corner he couldn't manage, and he was eager to learn it. Our first reading course was on deceit and self-deception, and it soon became clear who the teacher was and who the student was. He was a master at propagating deception. He was a master at seeing through deception. He was a master at beating your self-deception out of you, and like so many of the rest of us, he fell down when it came to his own self-deception. He had strong views on self-deception. He regarded it as very dangerous. Polluting the temple was one metaphor he used, and then after the crash of the Air Florida flight, a metaphor we both used is that when there's self-deception in the cockpit, no one's flying the airplane. A second view that I really liked was that he regarded the moral status of deceit with self-deception as being even lower than the moral status of consciously propagated deception. The very reverse view was the common view in U.S. culture. For example, during the Vietnam War in the late 60s, it often seemed strange to me that people would defend leaders because they sincerely believed that bombing and napalming the Vietnamese was in the best interest of the Vietnamese. So if they sincerely believed it, it wasn't so bad as if they were cynically propagating the notion. Another argument he had, which I liked very much on the moral status, was that with deceit and self-deception, you're lying to two people with deception. Oh, thank you. Okay. Thank you. You're lying to only one. And finally, he emphasized repeatedly the need for a logic, because it pleased me to bring him yet more examples of deceit and self-deception in our species. But the examples, if not infinite, at least are not going to run out anytime soon, and they're continually being regenerated, as a glance at any daily newspaper should convince you. Huey was shot to death in Oakland in 1989 and not by the police. So I dedicate this with fond memory to these two people. The general argument we worked on was that self-deception would evolve in the service of deceit. You lie to yourself, the better to lie to others. And perhaps I will just... let me just give you a sort of a view of this. First of all, self-deception required that you store true and false information simultaneously in you. If you've only got false information, you may have, for example, been fooled by another organism. But the counterintuitive fact and the interesting fact was that the true information is hidden in the unconscious with the false information in the conscious mind. And you might well think that if you had to split information, you'd rather do it the other way around and have true information get the benefits of conscious mentation, whatever exactly they are, and not keep the truth in the unconscious. And so the view was that this is actually oriented toward an observer, And what you first see when you watch me is my conscious mind, or what it's immediately producing, and the unconscious will be far more difficult for you to detect. Now let me elaborate this argument a little bit, if I may, and give you four different examples of self-deception in the service of deceit. First of all, the simple denial that you're engaged in verbal deception. So, for example, if I'm lying to you now about something you actually care about, consciously lying, you may pay attention to the quality of my voice, the quality of my eye movement, my sweaty palms, if you can get to feel them, anything that goes along with the stress that's associated with attempting to lie to other species, another individual. And incidentally, we have some very interesting, very good studies in birds that suggest that other creatures react with great hostility when they realize that they're being deceived or someone's attempting to it, and they beat up the other bird. And so there's a stress associated with consciously propagated deception, which if you can just cut it out of consciousness, you can then envelop it with the sincerity we seem to prize in our leaders. A second example, which I think is much more widespread than you may imagine from this example I'm going to give you, is that we may often have little unconscious modules hidden away here which direct selfish and deceitful behavior. And I'll use an example from my own life, if I may. I've discovered over many years that I'm an unconscious petty thief. I steal small useful objects, and I'm completely unconscious of it while I'm doing it. So I will steal your pencils and your pens. If I'm in a smoking mode, I'll steal your matches and your lighters, that kind of stuff. And while I pocket it, I am completely unconscious of it, still am. And this has been going on for at least 35 years. And judging how quickly my younger brother caught my hand once, I was probably going on from childhood. Now, I realized at Santa Cruz about 10 years ago that this behavior was beginning to get out of hand when I was lecturing to about 90 students on social behavior, and with a piece of chalk at the board, as is my preference, when the piece of chalk disappeared, and there was only one piece of chalk. And I searched, the students searched, then I sent a runner down the hall, got a chalk to continue the lecture. Well, that night I'm emptying my pockets, as is my habit before going to bed. The piece of chalk is right here in the rear pocket, so I stole it in front of 90 people, the 90 students and myself. Now, at first, I used to think that the point about this was that if someone caught me and accused me of it, I would put on a wonderful act of unconsciousness, because I was unconscious. Oh my God, I didn't mean to do that, and give it back. But later on, I began to think that, after all, if you want to steal a pencil or a piece of chalk and give a lecture, the part of your brain running the lecture really shouldn't be thinking about the piece of chalk, and you're probably not going to steal too well if you're conscious of the things going on. So there's this little unconscious module which is studying not only the behavior of the class, but my own class, and presumably doesn't have to attend to the lecture or its details very carefully, steals a piece of chalk. Well, of course, the problem is I don't have a blackboard at home. Yet ever since then, at the end of every semester, I've got three or four pieces of chalk at home. So this little unconscious module is starting to get out of hand. I find that I steal from both ends of my day, so I may leave my own office with my pocket stuffed full of pencils and pens. If I download them at home, I'll come back and have nothing to write with. I've actually had to train myself to pat my pockets and leave half the stuff behind. I've been thinking of buying a blackboard to make this thing work better, but I don't, you can appreciate I don't want the tail wagging the dog. Anyway, the most recent example of this was down in Jamaica, where I have a large project studying fluctuating asymmetry in about 300 children. And I stole right from the desk of the principal of the school his full set of keys while he's there, to the double locked computer room, to various rooms, to his vehicle, to his home. And I stuck them in this pocket, which I almost never put my keys, the better presumably to remain with me. I knew immediately who had them when they drove up and tentatively asked if perhaps I had the keys. And I think, thinking back on it, that I remember when it actually happened, and that was when I was paying him back a small sum of money for a service the school had rendered, and was thinking at the time that perhaps I was paying him $5 too much. And so I must have said inside, well, if that's for him, then the keys must be mine. There are two points I want to emphasize. One is that this thing keeps going right on. If Sigmund himself had me on a couch for 20 years, I swear at the end of the 20 years, a part of me would still be trying to pilfer that nice gold-tipped pen he had. And the second thing is that as time goes on, it's beginning to work against me, as the last three examples suggest. And maybe the fact that it's an unconscious module has something to do with the fact that it's got a life of its own. Okay, so that's the second example. And I imagine, though I think they're more difficult to spot, that we may have unconscious modules that act in social relationships, not stealing objects, but doing other kinds of things with a similar kind of logic. Well, a third and much more major area of self-deception with a bigger literature is a tendency for us to project a public persona of being beneficial to others and effective in our action towards others, beneffective, as a psychologist, Anthony Greenwell, coined the term. So people routinely overrate themselves when you ask them to compare themselves to others. If you ask high school seniors in the U.S. to rate themselves on leadership, fully 80% say they're in the better half in terms of leadership ability. As you know, you can hardly beat our own profession for high achievements in self-deception. So if you ask academics the same question, 94% say they're in the top half of the profession. And a whole series of biases support this kind of thing, and it has been studied in some detail. It is true that you can set up experimental situations where you require people to pay money when they make false guesses, and then you can bring them shockingly back closer to reality. For example, typical experiments are to do a group effort where you have five people, and then you tell them they beat the other team or they didn't. And if your contribution is 20%, which they've either measured or controlled, then if they say the outcome is positive, you say it's 25%. And if the outcome is negative, you say 15%. So you clearly know the real value because you're setting it up and down depending on the outcome. We have an unconscious tendency to switch voice from active to passive depending on whether the outcome was positive for others or negative. And I'll just give you one example, which I've used a lot, but it's still my favorite, of a man that ran into a telephone pole in San Francisco, and in explaining it to the police said, the pole was approaching my car when I attempted to swerve out of its way and it struck the car. So that switched the responsibility rather to the telephone pole. And finally, a very important kind of self-deception, in my opinion, which I'm not going to develop here, is that we want to create social theory that's biased in our own favor. And I don't mean just as social theorists who do that for a living. You may have a theory of your marriage, which you would like to be biased towards you. She's the one who's the selfish individual. You may have a theory of your office place or of the larger society. And all kinds of biases creep in there. I'll just give you one from recent events in the U.S. There are a lot of people, apparently, who seriously believe that if President Clinton gets away with perjury, the U.S. judicial system is going to collapse. But anybody with more than a passing acquaintance with the U.S. judicial system know that it's virtually built on perjured testimony. The word for testifying that the police use, the police, is testifying. Are you testifying today? Yes, I've got to testify in such and such a case. So there would be many more examples that could be given and a logic developed there, and I'm just going to skip it now. Let me see one second here. Now, it's vital to have concrete examples, and some personal examples can be concrete, as I hope mine was, but also concrete kinds of data and data that get you inside the creature with objective evidence. And I'm tired of being John the Baptist in the wilderness on this one, because I've been preaching the value of continuing this work. Guren Sackheim's beautiful 1979 demonstration of self-deception. And what they needed to have was some avenue into the unconscious, and they used voice recognition. And here you have change in the galvanic skin response, which is associated with physiological arousal, in response to hearing 2, 4, 6, 12, 24-second segments of people talking, either self or other. And you can see when it's 2 seconds, you can barely tell them apart, and then you get the narcissistic ascent here. Yes, that's me. You're sort of losing interest as you realize that's other. And of course, we are unconscious of our galvanic skin response. So then you can play a game in which you create a super tape of these 2, 4, 6, etc. second segments that have been chopped out of a matched age and sex sample of people reading the same boring paragraph from Thomas Kuhn's book on scientific revolutions. And if you do that, you then get this distribution. You have 4 categories of people in this situation. That in itself is of some interest. You have those who just make no errors. And here's their average galvanic skin response when they recognize themselves, and here when they realize it's someone else. You have one set of people who deny their own voice some of the time, and that's the only mistake they make, and I'll come back to them in a second. You have a group of people who project their own voice some of the time, and hear themselves talking when they're not, and that's the only kind of mistake they make. And then, bless their confused heads, you have a set of people who make both errors, and as I'll show you, even fool their skin in one of the cases. So let's just leave aside this and leave aside this and make this our paradigm. Here's your response when you accurately see yourself, when you accurately see others. Here's where you deny yourself. The same response as when you correctly recognize yourself. So the skin's got it right and the mouth's got it wrong. When you interview people afterwards, deniers, virtually all of them deny the denial. There was only one that admitted that he thought he made some mistakes of that form. Now here are the projectors correct in the 2 cases, and here's where they say it's their own voice, but again, the skin's got it right. Now projectors are a more relaxed set of people. When you interview them afterwards, half of them realize they were making a mistake some of the time, and that the form of the mistake was to project their voice when it wasn't really happening. And then finally, Goren Sackheim showed that you could manipulate people's tendency to deny or project by using well-worn psychological tricks for people to make people feel good or bad about themselves. You bring them in, give them a test, and then tell them you did good on the test or you did bad, but you're just handing these things out at random. You have a mirror in the hallway, which is what you actually care about now, the dependent variable. When you're told you do badly on your way out, you take one look at the mirror and then you keep going. Now, when you're told that you do well, you turn and you crimp and you say, you know, doing good and looking good while I do it. So they showed that by making people feel bad about themselves, they start denying some of their own voices. And when they're made to feel good about themselves, they start projecting their own voices. Now, needless to say, we did not evolve hearing our voice from tape recorders, so you have to kind of interpret these results. But the interpretation that I give, and I think Goren Sackheim gives, is that you expand your presentation with success and you shrink it with failure. Now, that was published in 1979, and there was one trivial debunking follow-up study which didn't prove a thing against the theory, and there has been no other work at all. It has dropped like a stone to the bottom of the discipline of psychology. I often contrast it with students to the Hamilton and Zook paper on parasites and mate choice that was published in 1982, perhaps similar within their disciplines and importance, a novel theoretical argument and a set of empirical data that drew attention to it. There is now a virtual industry out there in that tradition, upwards of perhaps a couple of hundred papers now published and in press. We do meta-analyses of Dr. Hamilton's theory, etc. That's the virtue of a discipline with a single central paradigm. There's also a slight difference between biologists and psychologists in that a lot of biologists are wedded to their organism and perfectly happy to switch what they're doing on that organism to something more interesting and bigger payoff and better grant-getting opportunity, whereas all the humanologists are stuck with the same species and often divide themselves up on their methodological approach, which they have been trained into them and they're reluctant to give up. But there's all kinds of follow-up work that can be done. It looks, a casual glance at it, statistics were never done, that deniers actually, in general, are more responsive, you know, are more heightened in response than those that are accurate, indeed, than all the other categories. And that is of interest because denial may require that you be a little bit focused on something, spot it, deny it, and so on. Incidentally, some people think you got to be real quick about that, but there's some very interesting neurophysiological work that suggests that you've got upwards of about a half a second to keep things out of consciousness, because the signal that hits here takes 20 milliseconds to reach the brain, but may take about a half a second to then actually register in consciousness. So there's plenty of time to filter it any way you want. It's a tremendous missed opportunity. What voices do you start hearing as your own? Are they the more attractive of the other voices? Do you deny the less attractive of your own, et cetera, et cetera? No follow-up at all, even though this is a route into the unconscious so that you can do the conscious-unconscious comparison. Now, I came across a study a year ago, which is the same kind of methodology, and I kind of liked it. They were studying homophobic men. These are men who are afraid of male homosexuals, uncomfortable around them, etc., and wanted to study their behavior in a situation I'll describe. Well, how do you find out whether someone's homophobic? Well, you give them a homophobia scale. And that consists of 25 questions, of which I would feel comfortable working closely with a male homosexual, you know, 1 to 5. Angry, there's only one anger in there if I'm approached, feel comfortable knowing I was attracted. Deny, there's only one denial in there. I would deny to members of my peer group that I had friends who were homosexual. Disgust, but most of it is discomfort, okay? Now here comes the fun part. You take fully heterosexual men by the Kinsey criteria. They've never done a homosexual act and they've never had a homosexual fantasy. You now give them the homophobia scale. Turns out they're all somewhat homophobic, but you spread them as to those that are more or less homophobic. And the fun part is that you then show them dirty movies. Oh, you first attach a plethysmograph to the base of the penis, which I'm told measures very small changes in diameter. It presumably measures large ones as well, but it is sensitive to very small ones. So these men are hooked up with a plethysmograph, and now we show them dirty movies. Okay, and I won't tell you which is which at first, but in any case, if they watch 4 minutes of a couple getting it on, you can see the engorgement of the penis here as time goes on. Here they're watching two women have sex. Again, no significant difference between the two. Arousal not quite as great as this. Now we show them two males getting it on. And the non-homophobic men show a slight and non-significant increase in tumescence, but the homophobic men are up here almost as good as the lesbian response. Now, of course, one imperfect form of the analogy is we're unconscious of our galvanic skin response, but we're conscious of our penis, and certainly with a plethysmograph attached to it, you'd think you'd be specially oriented toward it. But when you interview these people after the fact, both of these sets of men in all situations are accurate in describing their level of arousal and their separately their guesses to degree of tumescence, except for this category. All other situations are accurate, and these fellows are denying their arousal and denying their tumescence. Well, if you have some homosexual inclinations, but you're an A1 heterosexual type, as you're projecting yourself, you might be more uncomfortable with a homosexual male close to you. It might reveal something about you to yourself and others. That's the only other study I know along these lines. Now let me mention one third line of evidence that's been pushed forward recently that suggests a difference between which of your side of your brain, left or right, is involved more in self-deception. I don't know how long ago it was. It must have been 20 years ago probably now. The FBI set out to buy some U.S. congressmen. It turned out to be very easy to do so. They dressed up in Arab chic outfits and sat in hotel rooms and bought them. Okay. Now, this is a congressman who's just been kicked out of Congress. This is his lawyer holding his arm here. And you see this asymmetry in facial expression very clearly here, at least to me. The right side of the face, controlled by the left brain, is sort of keeping up some kind of plausible act. You know, maybe he can pull this off, it ain't so bad. This looks like death warmed over. The left side of the face, controlled by the right brain. And there are studies that back up this sort of thing. I believe I saw one example of it recently back to the U.S. the day President Clinton decided to apologize to the nation. Not when he made his talk in August, which no one liked, but in September when he started going around saying, I'm sinning and so on. The very first day, to my eyes, this side of the face and the left side of the brain was into it. And this side was saying, get me the hell out of here. But two or three days later, he had both sides working on that. Okay, a man by the name of Ramachandran or something like that has pointed out some very interesting facts about people that have a stroke. So that they've got damage to one side of the brain, and of course the other side is paralyzed. And it turns out that if the left side of your brain is paralyzed, you had the stroke in the right brain. Well, let me reverse it, sorry. Let's assume that this you're paralyzed on the right side, so the stroke was over in the left brain. Those people are rational when you ask them questions. Can you raise this hand? No. Can you raise the other hand? Yes. Why don't you raise this hand? Well, you know I've had a stroke, doctor, and so on. But when you reverse the situation, when the left brain is doing the talking because the stroke is over here, you get the most remarkable denial. They will deny that they have a problem. They will even sometimes claim they did raise their hand. You got to show them back a movie that they didn't raise it. Then they'll give another explanation. Well, my arthritis is acting up, or I didn't feel like raising it. There's much more detailed descriptions of this phenomenon, but it is most interesting in suggesting that the left side of the brain is, forgive the term, the bullshit center. It's in the literature. And that maybe it's especially sharp, this distinction, in these kinds of people, because the right brain is not there to moderate the left brain, so it's kind of out of control in its deceptive behavior. There's a very interesting interaction possible, as I'll come to now or shortly, between genomic imprinting and self-deception. It'll be most interesting to find out whether maternally active genes and paternally active genes differ in their degree of expression in the left and the right side of the brain. So let me go on to the next slide. In some ways, I hate this slide because it shows that in my dotage, I've become a pluralist. And there's a windbag or two at Harvard who regard pluralism as the alternative to logical, careful thinking. But I really do think that there are multiple factors that interact. One, of course, is good old parent-offspring conflict, and I attach less significance to it now for various reasons I won't go into. But for example, you can imagine that particular kinds of self-deceptions might start in that relationship. If you had a parent that was giving you deficient investment but required a reassurance display at the end of the day, you might get into the reassurance display and believe you loved them and so on, at least while you were under their control. This was something I thought I commonly saw at the time among some academics and other kinds of people, that actually they were low investors in their children when you check time and energy and so on. And at the end of the day, they had this exact, they look, mommy loved me, yes, and the child goes, I love you too. And that could induce a particular kind of self-deception, perhaps. There are others, and I will skip because I want to get on to internal genomic conflict. The basic logic for internal genomic conflict is that our genetic elements have different rules of inheritance and therefore measure different degrees of relatedness or coefficients of relatedness to other relatives. The Y related to other men and male relatives, but not to women and so on, mitochondrial DNA passing down the female line. But those are minority elements, the Y chromosome against all the rest of the genotype or mitochondrial DNA against all the rest of the genotype. But genomic imprinting pits half of the autosomes in principle against the other half of the autosomes. It also pits the X chromosomes against each other. So what is genomic imprinting? Genomic imprinting refers to, that just says unimprinted up there and there's a circle here. Genomic imprinting refers to an exception to Mendel's rules, very interesting, namely genes that act differently depending on which parent contributed the gene to you. So in the typical case, the copy from one parent is inactivated. So you have paternally active genes, which in which the paternal copy is active, or maternally active genes, in which the reverse is the case. Now, this is good old-fashioned Hamiltonian kinship. You start with a gene in you. There's a half chance it came to mom, half chance it was passed down to your half-sibling related only through mom, half times a half's a quarter. But with imprinting, you now have exact information on parental relatedness, and that sets up an internal conflict. A maternally active gene, and let's say we want to model the spread of the active gene, it certainly came from mom, one times a half, so the maternally active gene is related to the maternal half-sibling by a half. Paternally active gene sure didn't come from mom, it came from dad. So the quarter degree of relatedness now has been split into a half and zero, and that's a big difference in life situations in which you're computing degrees of relatedness. Most of the work so far has dealt with early parent-offspring and sibling relations, wonderful work of David Haig, now at Harvard, but perhaps not there for much longer, who knows. Anyway, he has developed the kinship argument in some considerable detail. And if you have a mixed litter of offspring inside a mouse that are partly full siblings and partly half siblings, it's easy enough to show the paternally active genes are going to be relatively selfish in actions towards the other siblings and towards mom in particular. And the maternally active genes will be much more congenial to mom's self-interest, if you will. And there's evidence, and I won't go into it. The interesting thing is that at least half of the genes, I would say, described now appear to operate later in life or to operate in the brain. And then you can talk about adult kinds of conflict. And I'll just give you perhaps one quick example here. Let us say that you are contemplating, I'll make it me, sexual relations with my first cousin related through mom. I'm related by an eighth in the old-fashioned way if mom and her sibling are full siblings. But maternally active genes sure came from mom, half chance, half chance. So maternally active genes, a quarter related to this individual, paternally active gene, unrelated. Now, in contemplating whether to go ahead with the act from an evolutionary standpoint, if you were making an evolutionary calculation, you weigh the increase in relatedness, it's a 25% increase in relatedness, versus a decrease through inbreeding depression resulting from the inbreeding. And if the increase in relatedness outweighs the decrease through inbreeding depression, the maternally active genes ought to say, kissing cousins are cute and there's nothing wrong with it. Whereas you can imagine hearing a paternally active voice in you emphasizing the defects thereby generated, a kind of moralistic tone. I emphasize that it can reverse if the mating is in the other direction or if you change some of the assumptions here. But you can get an argument inside yourself then between the paternal half of your genome and the maternal half of your genome, and you can presumably have deceptive techniques evolving where the one part overemphasizes the defects generated, let's say, and the other one underemphasizes them. It would be kind of like selves deception, where you have a maternal self and a paternal self, whereas before I've been using self to refer to the conscious self. Some of the most interesting evidence regarding genomic imprinting are indirect and have to be taken with caution. They come from growing chimeric mice that have a a mixture of normal mice cells plus either parthenogenetic or gynogenetic cells that have a double dose of maternal cells, or androgenetic cells that have a double dose of paternal genes, I should say. So they have only paternally active genes and no maternally active, or vice versa. And it turns out in these chimeras that these different kinds of cell types do well in some tissues, not in others, suggesting that those tissues may be, in a normal individual, show more paternally active expression, let's say. Not certain. Well, if you review, as Dr. Burt and I have in a recent chapter, the distribution of paternal and maternal genes, as it would look like from this, then you see that the cortex, neocortex, is where parthenogenetic cells do very well. Maybe there are more maternally active genes there. The hypothalamus here is paternally active. Paternally active genes do well there. The parthenogenetic cells don't prosper, etc. Now, this is entirely imaginary, but you could argue under certain vision of mice social life that the maternal genes would be much more involved in social interactions, in females at least, with other females and so on. You might have an internal argument, I'll give the human form of it now, where the maternal genes say, family's important, I believe in family. I'd like to invest in family. And the hypothalamus says, I'm hungry. This deals with hunger and growth, the more egocentric aspect of it. Now, I warn you that if you get too deeply into Hegelian logic, you can get into some weird states of mind. I've been offering students Nobel Prizes for some time if they can explain why dentin in the teeth appears to be maternally active more and the tissue-producing enamel paternally active. The only hypothesis that Austin Burt and I can come up with is that, well, enamel may have expensive trace elements, not metals, that are expensive to mother and valuable for offspring, just like brown adipose fat is rich in energy, and therefore the more selfish paternally active genes may express it. But to show you the kind of mental state you can get into, I've always thought of teething as an example of a genuine developmental process that's just intrinsically painful, because you got to form the teeth and move them up and get them into the bone. Now I sometimes wonder, late at night, whether there's a fight going on also between these two, and whether that contributes at all to the pain. The interaction regarding imprinted genes and side of the brains, I've already mentioned that you might argue in certain situations, and you know evolutionary theory is flexible, so we can always flip it upside down if we need to, that paternally active genes might be more involved in the bullshit center, let's say. And such is the progress of genetics that an answer to the question of whether there's an asymmetry is, I would have said, within our grasp within 10 years, but Dr. Badcock was just telling me that the latest story on paternally active versus maternally active genes on the X chromosome in humans, coming out of Skou's work on Turner syndrome women, shows that there's an asymmetry in brain action during certain kinds of tests. This has not yet been published. I take it on faith. But the point is, progress there will allow us to see whether there's an interaction between self-deception and the kind of deceit and self-deception I've been emphasizing. And I believe, correctly, that does that.
Okay. Yeah.
And not bring the screen up, too, in case I need it. Oh, sorry, I ran the thing off. Yeah, keep it going. But I also had something in there about the regulation of negative traits. This is regarding the more general subject of internal voices that are arguing with ourselves. You can argue on the parent-offspring conflict that we might have a reason to have a paternal voice in there, and some of the argumentation is this introgressed parental voice, I should say, versus offspring voice. But also, I believe that all of us have defective characteristics, and some of them are probably genetic in all of us. And I don't mean just the rare negative mutant. Bill Rice's wonderful work on sex antagonistic genes, these are genes which, when found in a male, are positive, but when found in the opposite sex, are negative. And of course, if the benefit's greater than the cost, they'll spread, are widespread in Drosophila. And so we may naturally, just as a consequence of ongoing evolution, have certain kinds of traits that are negative. They'd be the same gene will be positive, and more so in the opposite sex. And one wonders whether selection could not favor some superordinal kind of mechanism that scans your own behavior and tries to get you to stop certain things, which, even if they're coming from a gene, are in fact disadvantageous to all of you, all of the genes, including the gene itself. Okay, now let me quickly try to turn to the remaining topics. Of course, it's important to study cost of self-deception and to work out the various costs that seem to make sense. I will just mention, of course, being out of touch with reality is an ultimate cost in my mind. You can imagine, back to the pilot and co-pilot, that the pilot's overconfidence worked in many situations. May even work when he's flying the plane, may have worked in various personal interactions, may have given him slight benefits over the years in having people think more highly of him than they ought to, but pay a dreadful cost in a crisis situation. A second kind of cost of self-deception is that I think you're more vulnerable to manipulation by others. Huey and I reviewed the literature on con artists, and he had some talents in that direction, I might add, as well. And con artists routinely talk, in translating into this language, that they look for your self-deceptions, and then they fan them and inflame them, and then lead you around by the nose afterwards, whether it's your greed and your thought you can get rich quick or whatever it is. There's a really nice quote from a world-class American con artist that ran off with tens of millions of dollars of people's money in phony investment schemes. And it said, "I pluck their dreams out of their heads and sell the dreams back to them. Give them a damn good price, too." So I will say no more about that at the individual level. But I want to turn now to self-deception within an organization and a group. And I think it's especially relevant to disasters that our leaders can foist on us and so on. And I refer to the brilliant analysis of Richard Feynman of the Challenger disaster. You remember the Challenger disaster that blew up in roughly 1986. And he was put on the panel that was supposed to find out the cause. And it took him a week with the help of a general who gave him some useful information to locate this O-ring as the element that failed. But what is not widely recognized is that he spent the next 6 months in a full court press trying to figure out how on earth an organization like NASA, with the mega billions being spent and scientific quality of the work, could come up with such a lousy part. And the analysis, which was published in a book of his, and I urge any of you interested in the subject to seek it out, was very congenial to the kind of the thinking that I've done at the individual level. He said that NASA, when it went to the moon in the 60s, was engaged in something which, for better or worse, U.S. society was agreed was a good idea. So it didn't have to sell nothing to it, and it built from the ground up in a rational way, trying out lots of alternative strategies and so on. Then they get to the moon. Now you've got a $5 billion bureaucracy with no work to do, and now you invent the shuttle, which was deceitful from the beginning. The shuttle was sold as being inexpensive. You're going to reuse the thing. And of course, the fact that you've got a reusable thing means you ought to keep reusing it. So you've got to do frequent manned flights. Turns out it's more expensive to use the shuttle than just to start with a new vehicle. And what happened then, according to Feynman, was a split in the organization. between the top and the bottom. We'll call it the conscious and the unconscious, if you want. Where this section are selling now this program to Congress and the U.S. people, and they've got to misrepresent the safety of the thing, the value of it, et cetera, et cetera. They start discouraging hearing true information from the low working scientists. They design from the top down, because the whole thing is meant to serve this phony purpose in the first place. And what was especially remarkable to me in his analysis was his study of the little safety unit that was supposed to be considering safety. But really, they're also reporting up to these higher-ups who want to hear that things are safe. And so even that unit was corrupted. You would think that you could have a little unit hidden off there that really rationally considered safety factors. And they came up with all kinds of remarkable mental operations. There had been 24 previous shuttle flights. Seven of them showed O-ring damage. As Feynman showed, if you simply plotted chance of O-ring damage against temperature, which was the key variable, you got a significant negative relationship. But these people in the safety unit avoided coming to that conclusion by the following mental trick. 17 flights showed no damage. They are irrelevant. Of the seven that showed damage, some occurred at high temperatures. Temperature is not relevant. You know, every time I hear that tired old phrase, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to what, I think of this analysis. How about this for linguistic usage? In one of those seven with damage, the O-ring had been eaten a third of the way through. If it's eaten all the way through, you're dead. They rationalize that by saying, we've built in a threefold safety factor. Whoa. That's an unusual usage of language. In the U.S., an elevator has to be built with an 11-fold safety factor, which means you build an elevator strong enough to load it up with all its people, run it up and down with no damage, and then you build it 11 times stronger. Anyway, I recommend that. Oh, by the way, they finally were caught in the web of their own lies in that actual flight, because that was the flight whose justification was that a teacher was going to be sent up, Christy McAuliffe, one of the ones killed, and she was going to beam down classroom lessons to elementary school children. 5 million children were going to learn something extra because it was coming from outer space. It turned out that if they did not fly on January 26th, I think it was, given weather patterns and this and that, the next flight you could fly was in the summer. There are no children in school then. So that was the pressure on it. Now, it's not as if true information is forgotten. The 12 engineers, Thiokol engineers, that came up with this gizmo, the O-ring, all of them voted not to fly. One was vomiting in the bathroom during the flight, I mean, just before the flight. The leader of the group came over to the NASA headquarters, and they said to him, now take off your engineer hat and put on your management hat. And he switched his vote. They didn't have to provide hats for him to make that mental operation. So anyway, enough on that. Let me just tell you one story, and then I apologize for running slightly over time. I'll try to summarize. I was invited by, of all people, the Pentagon to make a presentation right around 1990. I was disappointed they didn't take me into the building itself. They met somewhere else in Arlington, Virginia, with a head of the Office of Net Assessment. And that office's duty was to assess the threat from the Soviet Union, and subsequent events showed that they had been overestimating that threat for some time. Well, what do you talk about when you're invited by the U.S. government to give a presentation? Deceit and self-deception, naturally. So I gave my presentation. There were a few jokes. Someone said every bureaucracy should have a little office of self-deception, and I thought to myself, yes, preferably down in the basement, and so on. But here's what startled me. The Soviet Union had imploded. So you had a kind of analogous situation there where you had the USA, the Defense Department or whatnot, against the USSR, its rationale vis-a-vis them. This unit collapses. Now you've got a huge bureaucracy, a $300 billion bureaucracy, dollar bureaucracy, that has got to find work to do. And I heard at that meeting these people discussing something which didn't come out in the newspapers till about a year later. Two rogue nations and the need to maintain a military force sufficiently strong to handle two simultaneous wars. And I believe it was Korea and Iran then, not Iraq. And I believe it was the first time I heard the expression rogue state. And now I can't read any newspaper, at least in the U.S., without having certain countries routinely referred to as rogue states. It suggests to me what is my final point here, and that is that I believe self-deception is not only an important topic in our personal lives, in dealing with our immediate friends or children or relatives, but it's also very important at the level of society. Can anybody really doubt that when we organize ourselves to produce a major disaster, like again the Vietnam War, that it is not an intellectual failing, a failing, as Professor John Maynard Smith would say, to get our sums right, but that it's processes of deceit and self-deception that propel us along the disastrous path all the way, providing us with the appropriate false information and so on. Barbara Tuchman, the historian, has written an excellent book on this subject called The March of Folly from Troy to Vietnam. And her concept is wooden-headedness, but the way she, that's what she calls it, but the way she defines it is exactly like self-deception. Indeed, she's fairly restrictive in the evidence that has to exist to prove self-deception. I naively thought that the Vietnam War would be the crowning story in her book. It is by no means so. She describes an appalling a disaster where some society can make peace with their neighbor, but this young leader gets whipped up the night before with his friends, a frenzy of self-deception. They attack, they're defeated, enslaved, 700-year disaster off of that kind of decision. So I think that we are dealing with an important topic, and that if we wish to prevent the kinds of human disasters that we're so good at designing, and of course we still wish to prevent nuclear disaster, and we wish to attend to various ecological disasters that we're capable of generating, that it would seem valuable to have a scientific theory of self-deception integrated with evidence from many different areas, and a growing one that's taken seriously. So I will summarize, as it turns out, by just pointing at the board there and saying that this is an activity that we can all engage in. You don't need to be an evolutionary biologist. You certainly don't need to be a psychologist. You can be an art historian, a novelist, a student of U.S. history. You don't even need to be an academic. Everyone is conscious of internal voices, conflict, and at least self-deception in others. So we can all take part. Thank you. I do think there's a connection, and I can't say much more than that. I certainly do think there's a connection. It reminds me to mention something. I think I left out positive illusions entirely, but the notion which I've resisted that self-deception was sort of internally beneficial without reference to others. I used to deride it as a can't get out of bed in the morning thing. You know, if we faced reality properly, we would just give up. But everybody knows that the placebo effect has to be corrected for in any kind of medical research in which you give pills. You must give them the control group a fake pill because there's a 30% kind of beneficial effect of just pretending that you're giving it. I point out for your sake that there's a slight analogy to the hypnosis thing, and the placebo effect requires another organism helping you, someone dressed up in a white frock with maybe a stethoscope handing you the pill and saying it's good for you. Sometimes people ask me why I'm taking a particular pill or vitamin, and I say, well, I want the placebo effect, and if it has any other benefits, I'll be happy to take it. But yes, I have not looked at the literature on hypnosis since Huey and I were actively working on it, which is 16 or 18 years ago, but absolutely.
So I'm going to ask a question following from that, Bob. Your data on the voice projection, it seems to me that dominance might come into whether you project your voice onto others or whether you deny your own voice when you hear it. I think we all know the type of person who says, oh, I said that, even when he hadn't, and the sort of person who said, oh, no, I never said that. And the former is tends to be a dominant person, the second one is someone who's always a bit nervous he's going to be caught and having said something and she wishes he hadn't.
Did they look louder?
You want me to restate it?
Perhaps you could restate it, yes.
Now let me remember what you just said. Oh, yes. Dr. Hamilton was speculating on whether there was an interaction with dominance and self-deception, and that we know people that overstate their
claim that they've said things.
Oh, claim they've said things
when they haven't said
them. When they never said things.
And other people who deny that they said things when they did say them, with the latter tending to be a rather nervous class of person.
Yes, so the former. Well, there's two reactions. There's two thoughts I have on that. First of all, that I neglected to mention that, in addition to the overrepresentation of self, there's a minority strategy, perhaps of downward deceiving. John Harding wrote an interesting paper on that. There are some people that it seems underrepresent themselves to others, and you could even make a functional argument about it in certain situations if it allows you to sneak in closer to someone that's useful to you. Some dominant organisms don't like particularly dominant ones around them, so someone that deceives downward can slip in and have a relation. But a second thought is suggested by Dr. Hamilton's comment, and that is a speculation that Huey and I actively engaged in, and I wish I had pursued since then, and that is that there might be a difference in deceit and self-deception, depending on where you were in a dominance hierarchy, with those on the top, perhaps, I don't know, practicing deceit with self-deception relatively more often, and those at the bottom practicing consciously propagated deception. One part of our argument was that there was a less of a moral problem justifying your deception if you feel you're on the bottom of things and are being exploited or mishandled than the notion that you steal from thieves, and that's fine, no particular problem. Whereas if dominant individuals are trying to sell an ideology of honesty to others because they want true information flowing from themselves, they may need to deny their own deception. Not quite a direct response to your question.
Mark Tagle. Some of the deception that you talk about is a kind of single, unitary individual deceiving him or herself. Other times it's competing voices, maybe the maternally and paternally imprinted inside the psyche. Which do you think is more common? What kind of deception is more common?
Well, I guess I could retreat behind the recency of work on genomic imprinting to say that it's not clear how important that would be. I've spent so much more time thinking about the original one that my initial response to you would just be, that self-deception to deceive others is the dominant mode, and there's an interaction with genomic imprinting. But I'd be by no means certain of that.
I was so struck by the novelty of your sub-stigma that I thought I'd test myself and see if I'd apply it to an outcome related to the impact. I was a modest, false modest thought. I'll try this one and see if I've learned how to do this. And so I thought, it works. If you take scientists at the beginning of the year asked to rate themselves in the upper or lower half, and you found a few of them who were obviously much better than they rated themselves. So they put themselves in the lower half and they should. I thought, let's divide them into two, the unconscious. The ones who are doing that unconscious, the unconscious of their true work, would be modestly downgrading themselves. So they're self-deceiving modest. Touch their lips, so I also say they're truly modest. Right? Whereas the other ones, who are consciously aware of their work and pitying it, so some are downgrading themselves, it's sort of lying to you, they're lower than they are they're lying with modesty, so perhaps that's false modesty, so it all works perfectly well. I've got false modesty and true modesty. Now I've got a problem, because they're the ones who accurately rate themselves lower than they are. And I don't have a category for them. I would have wanted to call them more. But I've done away with that category. Can you help me?
Well, the simple answer is no, I can't help you. But let me ask you, did all of those thoughts occur to you since I started talking today? Well, I take that as a great tribute to my lecture. And I must confess that the subtlety of your argument is sufficient, given the remaining intellectual resources here, that I can't quite grasp it all. But I think it's very interesting, and I would love to correspond with you or hear more about it. I do remember one comment to make with reference to Mark Pago's thought, and that is that one could, in principle, study self-deception in other animals as well. I understand that birds in one species, and I don't know the work, it's known they'll respond physiologically more strongly to their species song than a closely related species song. I understand there's evidence that you've got the same difference within the species to their own song versus other individual song when you use playback experiments. And then, so I would use that level of arousal on the bird as comparable to the galvanic skin response. And then I would train the bird to peck at something, which would be the nearest I could get to verbal behavior. But I don't think it would be, and that might be helpful in it'll be a couple of hundred years before this is realized, so this is real safe. That would be helpful eventually in seeing whether you were generating self-deception in other creatures in which genomic imprinting could not be a factor or was very unlikely to be a factor. Well, I take your point that my examples are all negative, and there's some people that think religion is pure self-deception. There are other people who think that it creates self-deception's finest hours, but it is not itself intrinsically self-deceptive. I sort of retreat when religion comes along because of the massiveness of the universe and the extraordinary length of time of evolution and so on. And our inability to conceptually or in terms of evidence get beyond the Big Bang or get deeper into the structure of things. And I tend to have a religious heart somewhere beating in me. But But I can't say more to your question than that, I'm afraid.
What I think, it's slightly related to the other questions. Now, the word deception itself is so charged emotionally, morally, ethically, like most of scientific terminology, like rental investment, which is charged with capitalist social relations, etc. What I'm trying to say is that, particularly in terms of your present lecture, all the examples of self-deception you gave are really, in a sense, shockingly reprehensible facts. Do you intend this, or can one find a scientifically less charged term, which is much more neutral say, scientific? I mean, I find the scientific terminology to be very unscientific.
Well, let me deal with the easy one first, I think, which is parental investment. Fisher's term was parental expenditure. So he unconsciously, if you will, emphasized the negative side of it. Well, it made sense in terms of the sex ratio argument he was given. The reason why I guess I liked the investment thing, and I was not consciously thinking of economic investment or capitalist dogma at all. Indeed, I'm a nitwit in those areas, both in my personal life and trying to comprehend what economists are actually saying or how they get to where they say it. I thought it was positive in the sense that you invest in these creatures with a future kind of return. Now, the more difficult one is the direct one on this talk, and I must say that my own thinking is in flux here, more towards the direction of seeing beneficial deception in which the effects are beneficial, and also imagining that there is something behind this positive illusion literature. But as you know, I'm just mastering it, and I put it up there and shrunk it down to nothing. Regarding deception being good, I don't know whether I dare reveal these kinds of thoughts. Let me see. Well, there are certain situations in marriage, I believe, where if you're going to do certain actions, you also have got to swallow the pill and lie about it. If you think the only problem with the behavior is concealing it from the other person, you're in for a very rude awakening when you try the sharing. And I recently lectured at Bennington College in Vermont on this and met a woman who was writing with another person a book on deception and self-deception in marriage, and she was far further along in her thinking than I was, and talked about shared self-deceptions at a certain stage of the relationship and positive benefits and so on. So I take your point very much. There's a whole negative cast and a moralistic cast to it too. Indeed, when I started with those first slides, who in earlier time was very, very harsh on dishonesty, thought that was dreadful and also had a hard time spotting it, that I found the literature on deception and nature sort of psychologically relaxing so that I could then see more self-deception, because then if you relax more about deception, you deny it less. But I don't have anything more precise to say in response to what you said. In respect to whether there's a...
That in addition to an organism, you know, making behaviors and living its life and so on, there's sort of a little me inside, a homunculus that's conscious and that makes the decisions. You mentioned the half-second delay in reaching consciousness. That and much other evidence suggests that we can't be doing those things.
Quite, and I'm afraid most of my answers are in the form of dodges here, but the dodge on that is that it's only recently that I become conscious of this very interesting neurophysiological literature. And I've been, I started, in fact, in September when I agreed to give this talk to try to master it, but I'm only a little ways into it. There is an illusion that Shelley Taylor, Professor Taylor, out in California somewhere, maybe UCLA, who's written excellent reviews and done excellent work on positive illusions, occurred to me just a couple of days ago. People are overly optimistic about the future. They see themselves as being more in control than they really are in certain situations. And she also had done some interesting work, experimental work, that showed that when you put people in a situation where they had to plan a course of action, they were much more rational in their evaluation of costs and benefits, let's say, than when they chose the course of action. Once they chose the course of action, then the machinery of self-deception, if you will, got engaged in a kind of positive spirit that she finds nice. I just had an illustration of that the other day at Silwood Park when I got news that yet another small grant proposal had been turned down. And, you know, within an hour I was conceptualizing this as actually a blessing in my life. It would allow me to do more genetics work and so on. And a day later, you know, I'm almost beaming from the turndown. But I must confess I've had so much experience at these turndowns that I start planning my fallback position before it happens. The one improvement that I'm proud to reveal is that I now no longer spend grants before I get them.
Valerie Curtis from the School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in London. Perhaps one of the positive aspects of self-deception amongst us academics is it enables us to feel good about ourselves and who describe it. Question, you jumped from the evolved psychological traits self-deception, right, into the culture, into the group, without really explaining how that happened. I'd really like you to explain how you see that mechanism, how you see, is it just pure analogy, or is there some sort of group selection going on, or why does culture demonstrate to you the same traits that evolved psychologists demonstrate?
Oh, I ain't going to answer the question. I'll say that right off the bat. I'm not thinking of a kind of group selection. And there is a problem there that I think you've very precisely located and that would be worth someone else working through. But I can't. I did just want to mention one thing, though, since you mentioned culture. And there is, as Dr. Taylor has pointed out in her writing, some suggestive evidence that this overvaluation of self as a general kind of phenomenon may be localized to Western culture or may not be universal, and that in Eastern culture you may have, at least in public, a kind of self-effacing style and so on. Whether you still tap, you know, I'm even better at being modest than you, and so we compete on that level. I don't know.
I'm afraid we're running short of time now. I think we'd really better ask one more question, and this is going to be the last.
Short one. Art in general, and particularly performing arts, are they exercises in self-deception and leading us to disaster?
I don't know.
Or it is the positive aspect that we're talking about, that there are certain illusions that they are necessary and positive.
Well, the I don't see art as immediately fitting in there at all, because the way I, you know, one way I've defined it is a biased form of information transfer within the organism with the bias towards the false information in the conscious mind. So I don't immediately see how art, which is, I mean, you can say it's creating an illusion if you want, I don't see how that maps onto the self-deception at all initially.
Thank you. performing arts.
Well, what about performing arts? Someone I'll dance over. So what's, where's the self-deception here in the performing arts? Are you talking about self-deception as a way of helping you act better? Well, if you're talking about that, yes, there's certainly, it certainly seems to be true. There are whole, well, there are whole method acting kinds of schools of thought, I gather, where you talk yourself into imagining that you're in a particular situation in order to get yourself in a parallel situation. Is it over? Okay.
Before we break up, I have one more thing to do. I'd just like to thank Bob again. Where else can we hear such a wide-ranging talk where matters which are familiar to all of us suddenly begin to appear in a new light? It's a really great pleasure to hear this speech here where I have so many memories. But before Bob leaves, I have a duty to give him a present, which I'm told as a custom of this show, and whether he opens it now or not, I don't know whether you're supposed to or not, but anyway, here it is.
Okay, thank you.
This is one from me, which I think I'll wait to see what this is before I open mine.
Oh, yes, lovely. Okay, thank you.
That's great.
Enduring love.